Hey there, infant listeners. We have a new patron of the month. You may remember that Heather Risk was our October winner. Heather donates $2 per episode with no monthly limit, and we released 8 episodes in October. So Heather won a reverse tithing prize of $160, which is 10 times the amount of her support for Infants on Thrones. So our new patron of the month for November is Ashley Whitney. Ashley joined Patreon on November 10th. She donates $1 per episode with a maximum limit of 4 episodes per month. So Ashley has won a reverse tithing total of $40. Congratulations, Ashley. I sent you an email earlier today and a message through Patreon. Hopefully, I'll be hearing from you soon. Congratulations again. Now, just a quick note on the episode today you're about to hear. First of all, I'm doing it primarily as a video episode first, but it's, you know, you may be hearing this as an audio before you go and look at the video. I talk about this in the introduction, but just so you know that up front. It's also largely my response to a kind of quirky neuroscience video on the brain that I found on YouTube, and it's pretty far out there. It covers a lot of mind-blowing stuff, in a pretty short amount of time. So I put this together a few days ago, and I shared it with my fellow infants to get their feedback. Tom was the only one that I heard from, and Tom had two main questions. First, why so much meta navel gazing in the first 10 minutes? Tom. And two, why do you keep saying we as if you're speaking for all of the other infants? So, to answer the first question, I want to frame my interest in this video as an extension of topics that we've been covering for the past year or so on Infants on Thrones. And this is kind of like a next step in that evolution of my interests, and I see this video as kind of an overview of the types of episodes that I want to be creating going forward. Like I said, it's pretty dense. There's a lot of information in there, so I want to take them piece by piece and have other episodes about them in the future. That's why the meta navel gazing. I'm trying to provide that context. And then the second question, the reason I say we instead of I, you know, I've never wanted Infants on Thrones to become the Glenn Ostlund show. I mean, that just makes me feel really uncomfortable. And I feel weird saying I, like somehow I'm excluding the others, when really I just want to include them. So I say we, and I add some qualifications, even though this episode in particular represents things that I'm primarily interested in. So that's why, Tom. So there you go. Cue the intro.
This is Infants on Thrones, the philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
Hey, welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and today I want to share with you some ideas that have become very important to me lately. And I'm going to ask you to respond to this episode with another survey, so there will be another survey on the website that you can go to and let me know what you think about this. And I'm making this episode primarily as a video first. So if you're listening to it, that's cool. You should be fine listening. But in a few minutes, you may be wishing that you were watching it. Now, the video that I'm making will be available for anybody to view on our Patreon page. You don't have to be a paying Patreon supporter to view it. I'll put a link on our website, infantsonthrones.com, so you can go and watch it. But let's start by taking a quick stroll. I say quick, but I've written like a page and a half here. a quick scroll down memory lane. So the podcast, Infants on Thrones, it started over 5 years ago, about 5.5 years ago. And it was because I think all of us involved in it, whether we were making it or whether it was you listening to it or influencing it with listener essays or feedback, whatever, we all recognized that the church that we grew up in, the Mormon church, was not what we believed it to be. And it's a painful realization for so many reasons. We've exhaustively gone through it. We know about this whole faith crisis thing. And Infants on Thrones talked about it. And maybe more importantly, we joked about it. We deconstructed it. We smacked it down. We used humor. And, you know, for those of us that were making the podcast, and also for those of you listening to it, I think that we helped each other detach a bit, at least, from the emotional pull that the church had on us. Now, maybe we haven't completely detached, different stages of detachment. But that's what Infants on Thrones has been to so many people. They send us messages that say, thank you for helping me realize that I wasn't alone going through this. Thank you for making me laugh when things seem so dark. Thank you for showing me that there's something valuable on the other side of this thing. Okay, and so we've detached a bit emotionally. So what? Why is that a big deal? Well, I think it's important because then it allows us to be better observers of what's going on without having all of the emotions dictating what we're thinking about it. But being able to have that kind of mindful awareness of what's happening, I think that's why I've done the TBM Whisperer thing, an exercise of being aware and observing what the Mormon Church role was in forming who we are. So that's what we've been doing. But for the past year or so, I think it's been pretty obvious that our interests, my interests, other of the infants' interests, have been waning when it comes to talking about Mormonism. I feel so emotionally detached from the church that having to focus on it has felt like taking a steps backwards when I really just wanted to keep moving forward. You know, so we identified what we were running away from, but what are we running towards? What is the future? Where are we going? Not just with Infants on Thrones, but after you separate from Mormonism, what's next? That's been a question that people have asked too, and I don't really have the answer to that, but there have been some patterns I think we can look at and see, okay, maybe this is the trajectory that we're going. So about a year ago, Jake said to me,
Hi, I'm Brother Jake. Hey, Glenn, you totally got to read this book, The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt. It's the best thing I've ever read since the Book of Mormon.
And so I did, and then I couldn't stop talking about elephants on this podcast for months, and you guys teased me for it, rightfully so. But 2 weeks ago, I got to sit down with Jonathan Haidt in his office at New York University and record an interview with him and Michael Ferguson for the Spiritual Brain podcast that just blew my mind. But I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So, The Righteous Mind. And then shortly after that, I got really interested in the Bill Bryson book, A Short History of Nearly Everything, and recruited several listeners to help me put together some content in this really ambitious and kind of cumbersome shown project that really became super overwhelming to put together, but taught me some things that have helped me later on. So it was good. I don't regret it. Of course, and the reason I did is because the messages in that book inspired me so much, and they started reawakening in me the awe, the wonderment, the fun that I used to feel towards these fundamental human mysteries, these questions like, why are we here? And how did we get here? And what's our place in the universe? You know, these kinds of questions. We did that with the Schoen Project. We started talking, of course, there were the politics, there was the Trump stuff we were trying to understand. And this led to discussions about echo chambers and belief systems and questions about shared values. We recorded an episode on the book Sapiens that may never see the light of day because we started arguing in the beginning of it about the definition of fiction and what should or should not be included as a fiction or not. You know, there's still more that I want to say about the book Sapiens and its sequel, Homo Deus, and the story that those two books tell. And it's similar to what I found attractive in The Short History of Nearly Everything. It's about the evolution of us, of Homo sapiens as a species, and the valuable role that intersubjective belief systems played in allowing us to cooperate with each other, and that's why we progress. You know, so religion, when you talk to Jonathan Haidt about religion, or what's his name, Harari, that wrote Sapiens and Homo Deus, he's not looking at it as an enemy. He's saying this played a valuable role. And that was helpful to be able to separate myself from Mormonism, get out, but then start seeing some of the value. And I've always been the TBM whisperer and all this stuff. Anyway, I really like it. I really like the way that this direction has been going. And I think this is the future of Infants on Thrones kinds of conversations. So you've noticed this shift in things. And then also, big thing in my personal life, last July, I lost my job that I'd had for 13 years. And I mentioned it on the podcast. And So many listeners reached out to offer their help and support, and I'm currently working for one of them right now. I'm producing a podcast that's called the Steady Trade Podcast, and then there's a YouTube video series that's going to launch pretty soon called The Tim Sykes Show, and these help people who want to learn how to become successful day traders earning money trading penny stocks. There's a plug for you, Zach. Thank you. And I was also, after that, hired by a guy named Kevin, who you heard from a little bit on the Spiritual Brain episodes that were published a few weeks ago, because Kevin wanted me to help him realize his vision of sharing a very valuable message to the world. And that's how I was able to meet Jonathan Haidt and record that interview between him and Michael Ferguson. So just a side note on the Spiritual Brain podcast, we kind of hit a snag with some creative differences in the ways that we want to work with each other. And so we're still working out exactly how that's going to go going forward. But that podcast, the Spiritual Brain podcast, is not going to launch on December 1st like we initially announced, and we're hoping that it would. And that's partly why I'm recording what I'm recording today, because that message was so important to me that I still want to get it out, or at least different versions of it. So, all right, I think that's it. So here's the video that I'm going to share with you, and let me just introduce this a little bit. So what you're about to hear or see, if you're watching this right now, is a video that I found on YouTube when I was looking for science videos to help me better understand the way that the brain works. This is a non-commercial, open-source publication that anyone's free to redistribute and remix. And at the end of the video, there's a long list of sources that are cited and reference materials to support the claims that are being made in the video. But my first reaction when I started watching it, because of the production values, it seemed like the kind of mumbo-jumbo that I initially reject, you know, or get really suspicious about because of the music choices. Or, you know, it reminded me of the movie What the Bleep Do We Know, if any of you have seen that, or The Secret. And that was kind of a turnoff. But, you know, listening to what he was saying, it became very clear very quickly. Okay, we're just talking about scientific stuff here. So it didn't help me that the narrator of the video on YouTube sounds kind of like a George Takei version of the
Stephen Hawking computer voice we use from time to time.
Oh my.
So what I'm going to do here, I'm going to play for you this video from YouTube. And again, keep in mind that I was a little turned off at first by the voice and the music. But don't let that discourage you, because the message is really, really, really important. And I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to watch it and maybe cut in from time to time, because there are thoughts that I had as I was watching, and I want to share that with you. What I really wanted to do, and maybe I'll do this at some point, is to have a panel discussion where we watch this and we respond to different things, and we can get more opinions and more voices than just mine on this. But this is important. It's something I want to share with you. So here you go.
The human brain is a network of approximately 100 billion neurons.
Oh my.
Different experiences create different neural connections which bring about different emotions. And depending on which neurons get stimulated, certain connections become stronger and more efficient, while others may become weaker. This is what's called neuroplasticity. Someone who trains to be a musician will create stronger neural connections that link the two hemispheres of the brain in order to be musically creative. Virtually any sort of talent or skill can be created through training. Rüdiger Gam, who was a self-admitted hopeless student, used to fail at basic math and went on to train his abilities and became a famous human calculator, capable of performing extremely complex mathematics. Rationality and emotional resilience work the same way. These are neural connections that can be strengthened. Whatever you are doing at any time, you are physically modifying your brain to become better at it.
Okay, that was my first holy shit moment. Whatever you're doing at any time, you are physically modifying your brain to become better at it. So, like, I'm really good at Angry Birds Evolution right now. My brain has, like, I've actually gotten really good at Angry Birds Revolution, the stupid little game on my phone that I sit and play, you know, like, a lot of the drops and things that I put on Infants on Thrones are because I watched so much pop culture and retained it. You know, it's there in my brain. I remember a lesson that I had in Sunday school once where they took and several of you probably had the same lesson where they took an empty toilet paper roll. And there were some dirty cotton balls that were all black and gross and some clean cotton balls. And they put the clean cotton balls in first and then they pushed in the dirty ones and the dirty one pushed the old ones out. And they're saying, this is what happens in your brain when you put bad content in instead of good content. And, you know, like this is one of those things that I would mock, right? You mock because you're like, oh, that's so stupid, da da da. But yeah, maybe there's something to that. And just because there's a lot of crap about Mormon, it doesn't mean that everything is. So maybe that was a good message and I should have been paying attention to it. Anyway, everything in here is making me question, like, what, like, there's certain things that I'm like, okay, yeah, I've kind of intuitively understood that. I've understood that that's what your brain does. That's why practice makes perfect. That's what, like, all these colloquial sayings, all of this wisdom about practicing and you are what you think. As a man thinketh, so is he. You know, all these things, they're peppered throughout the scriptures because these are observations that humans have made through time. They see, if this is really true, you would expect that people would have always seen it and recognized it, and that would be manifested somewhere in our culture, right? So we find it places, this common wisdom. Anyway, yeah, I'm super excited about this.
Since this is such a foundational mechanism of the brain, being self-aware can greatly enrich our life experience. Specific neurons and neurotransmitters, such as norepinephrine, trigger a defensive state when we feel that our thoughts have to be protected from the influence of others. If we are then confronted with differences in opinion, the chemicals that are released in the brain are the same ones that try to ensure our survival in dangerous situations. In this defensive state, the more primitive part of the brain interferes with rational thinking, and the limbic system can knock out most of our working memory, physically causing narrow-mindedness. We see this in the politics of fear, in the strategy of poker players, or simply when someone is stubborn in a discussion.
And we see it all over Infants on Thrones and the ex-Mormonism, and it makes sense, right? Because if we've been harmed, if there's pain around our faith crisis, separating ourselves from the church, family relationships, friend relationships, all of these things, we have these memories that are associated with this emotion of pain. And when there's something that comes that, you know, maybe there's like a supernatural element to this conversation. Maybe it's happening right now in what you're experiencing and feeling as you're listening to this. Maybe this is way too close to messages that you got in church. And because of that, your brain is bringing up, it's recalling the memory and the emotions that's attached to it. And then it triggers your fight or flight response. And you're like, oh no, I have got to, I can't hear this thing. It's way too painful. Attack, run, whatever you've got to do, because your brain's protecting you. Doesn't that explain so much of the ex-Mormon reaction, especially when it's still fresh in that, you know, that anger phase and how easy it is to trigger because that emotion is so attached to the memory. And that's why I think that the ability to detach emotionally is so important, and the ability to then be aware and watch what's happening and see what's happening. And this is going to go on and talk about this a little bit more, but this was another one of those things that I'm like, oh my gosh, this helps me understand what I've been going through since leaving the church and why I still get angry at things and people. And you could apply it into other areas. It's not just about Mormonism, but this is good stuff. It's good stuff.
No matter how valuable an idea is, the brain has trouble processing it when it is in such a state. On a neural level, it reacts as if we're being threatened, even if this threat comes from harmless opinions or facts that we may otherwise find helpful and could rationally agree with.
Okay, this reminds me of a story that I want to share with you. So when I was in New York a couple of weeks ago, I met Misha Nicole Griggs for the first time. Some of you may know who she is. Misha, I'm gonna read from her bio here because I want to make sure I get it right. But she's got a PhD in counseling psychology from BYU, and she completed her clinical training at the University of Washington. She's at Columbia University in New York right now, doing a postdoctoral fellow on somatic psychotherapy and social justice. Anyway, so Misha and I were talking the first night that we met. She didn't really know who I was. I didn't really know who she was. And Infants on Thrones came up. And she goes, "Oh, Infants on Thrones, those guys are just assholes." And I'm like, "You know that I'm like with Infants on Thrones, right?" She goes, "Oh yeah, because you're a podcast producer. You work with them." And I'm like, "Well, yeah, but I'm like, I am kind of on Infants on Thrones. I'm one of the assholes. I'm maybe the biggest asshole." And we got over it. But it was funny. And Misha's a good friend with Lindsay. And so, you know, Lindsay's been a great guest on some episodes with us. And I've really enjoyed getting to know Lindsay better over this last year. And I'm going to come back to some things that Lindsay has said on the podcast. But I reached out to Lindsay and said, "Hey, could you tell Misha that not all of the infants are assholes?" And Lindsay came back to me and goes, "Well, there was this one thing," and she shared with me this blog post that was written a couple of years ago that was published on Feminist Mormon Housewives that I never knew was there. I never saw it until this time. And it was in response to, I guess I can't say the word anymore. I jokingly call it remarkable. But you remember the conference talk with President Monson talking about Ted, who was tarred and feathered, and then he wanted to be tarred again. So he was the
remarkable
Ted. And, you know, that's a word that is like triggering to people, and listeners would respond to us, and we didn't care. As I was reading, we didn't care until we did. And that's the point that I want to make. How we got to the point, or me specifically, how I got to the point where I'm like, "Oh yeah, you know what? I don't want to be causing people pain by using that word." And even though it doesn't cause that pain to me, I can hear in other people that it is. And so, yeah, I'm going to stop doing it. But I came to that conclusion on my own. And I realized as I was reading this blog that Lindsay sent to me, how, like, I was observing my own reaction to what, like, how I was feeling in response to what this blog was saying. And because it was misrepresenting us and it was vilifying us, you know, for why, like, when we say that, we mean that somebody is horrible and stupid. And no, that's not what I mean. Actually, what I mean when I'm saying it is I'm making fun of people who aren't saying it ironically like I am. You know, like there's this distinction in my head that I can use it because I don't really think that way. And so it's okay. But it doesn't really matter when somebody's hearing it, like the distinction that I'm using it ironically or not makes no difference. I'm still using it. It's still triggering them. But it took me figuring that out on my own to do it. This kind of a blog post where they were like publicly shaming Infants on Thrones and it's creating this defensive reaction in me, it would do exactly what this YouTube video is talking about. It would release those chemicals in my brain that says I'm under attack, and then I start defending myself and I stop listening to ideas that are really good ideas because I just feel under attack. And that's what my brain's doing. It's protecting me, but it's also blinding me from being able to see these things. So something that Lindsay said a couple of times when she's come on the podcast recently is how to be more effective when you're working in conflict is to not escalate the conflict, but to de-escalate, to empathize, to look at things from their perspective. And there's a really important value doing that based on what this is saying here, the way that our brains respond, that so that you can have conversations and bypass the emotions that would otherwise put up walls. So I wanted to say all that, and I did just now.
But when we express ourselves and our views are appreciated, these defense chemicals decrease in the brain, and dopamine neurotransmission activates the reward neurons, making us feel empowered and increasing our self-esteem. Our beliefs have a profound impact on our body chemistry. This is why placebos can be so effective. Self-esteem or self-belief is closely linked to the neurotransmitter serotonin. When the lack of it takes on severe proportions, it often leads to depression, self-destructive behavior, or even suicide. Social validation increases the levels of dopamine and serotonin in the brain and allows us to let go of emotional fixations and become self-aware more easily.
So, you're welcome. Because what I think this means is that the experience that you've had as listeners of Infants on Thrones, and my experience in doing it, we've been giving each other social validation for this out-group, you know, that we are. We're the outcast now. We're the island of misfit toys, and we're there for each other. We're laughing with each other, and we're, you know, like those memories that were associated with pain when we're talking about certain things or we're hearing Boyd K. Packer's voice. Now, you think I'm too sexy. Now you think masculine, manly men. And we've replaced those memories or the emotion that's associated with those memories with something that is more validating. So we have more self-esteem from it. But it strips away like that pain and anger and replaces it with something that makes us feel better. So I don't have to feel so guilty that I've been like mocking the church all this time, because it really has helped me. Because this has been a struggle that I've had as I've done this podcast, is wondering, okay, am I just really, you know, shitting on people's beliefs and just being a horrible, horrible person? Even though I'd have messages coming in from people saying, oh, this is really helping me, it was something that was really hard for me to grasp. And this is helping me and filling me with serotonin and confidence and happiness and yay, 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 infant, yay, yay!
Social psychology often looks at the basic human need to fit in and calls this the normative social influence. When we grow up, our moral and ethical compass is almost entirely forged by our environment, so our actions are often a result of the validation we get from society. But new developments in neuroscience are giving us a better understanding of culture and identity. Recent neurological research has confirmed the existence of empathetic mirror neurons. When we experience an emotion or perform an action, specific neurons fire. But when we observe someone else performing this action, or when we imagine it, many of the same neurons will fire again, as if we were performing the action ourselves. These empathy neurons connect us to other people, allowing us to feel what others feel. And since these neurons respond to our imagination, we can experience emotional feedback from them as if it came from someone else. This system is what allows us to self-reflect.
Mirror neurons. Now, I think it was on Radiolab that I first heard about mirror neurons and started like recognizing that as a creator of a podcast, Infants on Thrones, when we laugh, you as a listener, your mirror neurons hear our laughter and respond to it, you know, so you feel and you laugh. And so he said in here, this is the way that we connect to each other. Now, is this like some metaphysical, the secret kind of magic? I'm having an impact on somebody at a distance where there's separation between us? There's nothing that's actually physically connecting us. Is that what this is saying? Or is there really something that actually physically connects us? I mean, like what you're hearing right now are physical sound waves that are hitting your eardrums and then sending electronic signals to your brain that it interprets for meaning. That's a physical thing, right? I'm sending physical sound waves right into your ears if you've got earbuds in. It's going right in there, right in there. And it's making a physical impact on you. And so I am. I'm reaching out through space and time and touching you. This is mind-blowing. And it's not magic. This isn't magic. This is like the world that we live in. Anyway.
The mirror neuron does not know the difference between it and others, and is the reason why we are so dependent of social validation and why we want to fit in. We are in a constant duality between how we see ourselves and how others see us. This can result in confusion in terms of identity and self-esteem, and brain scans show that we experience these negative emotions even before we are aware of them. But when we are self-aware, we can alter misplaced emotions because we control the thoughts that cause them. This is a neurochemical consequence of how memories become labeled when retrieved and how they are restored through protein synthesis. Self-observing profoundly changes the way our brain works. It activates the self-regulating neocortical regions, which give us an incredible amount of control over our feelings. Every time we do this, our rationality and emotional resilience are strengthened. When we are not being self-aware, most of our thoughts and actions are impulsive. And the idea that we are randomly reacting and not making conscious choices is instinctively frustrating. The brain resolves this by creating explanations for our behavior and physically rewriting it into our memories through memory reconsolidation, making us believe that we were in control of our actions.
Okay, so maybe this is totally obvious and I'm just like breaking into mansplain something, but this is the elephant and rider metaphor from The Righteous Mind that Jonathan Haidt talked about. These emotional gut feelings and emotions that we have are responses to things that are happening in our brain that we're not even aware of. We don't know. We're not thinking this and then it's happening. It's happening. And then our brain is creating this narrative, this post hoc narrative, and it rewrites our memories. Holy shit. Like that was something in graduate school years ago when I was studying folklore anyway, and Elizabeth Loftus came to the campus at Indiana University and she talked about the experiment Lost in a Shopping Mall, where they actually created false memories in a patient population. And she talked about that, how these subjects, after weeks of suggestion, would start to fabricate and create memories of an event that never actually happened, but they felt like it did. And when I realized that memories were unreliable, that was another one of those things that made me question the way that I thought about the church or the way that I thought about the Holy Ghost or things like that. So anyway, yeah. Yeah.
This is also called backward rationalization, and it can leave most of our negative emotions unresolved and ready to be triggered at any time. They become a constant fuel to our confusion, as our brain will keep trying to justify why we behaved irrationally. All this complex and almost schizophrenic subconscious behavior is the result of a vastly parallel distributed system in our brain. There is no specific center of consciousness. The appearance of a unity is in fact each of these separate circuits being enabled and being expressed at one particular moment in time. Our experiences are constantly changing our neural connections, physically altering the parallel system that is our consciousness. Direct modifications to this can have surreal consequences, that bring into question what and where consciousness really is. If your left cerebral hemisphere were to be disconnected from the right, as is the case in split-brain patients, you would normally still be able to talk and think from the left hemisphere, while your right hemisphere would have very limited cognitive capacities. Your left brain will not miss the right part, even though this profoundly changes your perception. One consequence of this is that you can no longer describe the right half of someone's face, but you will never mention it. You will never see it as a problem or even realize that something has changed. Since this affects more than just your perception of the real world and also applies to your mental images, it is not just a sensory problem, but a fundamental change in your consciousness.
Okay, so here's a what-if question. And, I may be totally off on this, but I still want to explore it. What they're showing here is that the half of the brain, it's not observing everything that's out there to be observed. It's only observing a part of it, but it thinks that that part is a whole, and it's blind to what it's unaware of. I don't know how much of our brain we actually use. You know, like you hear all these things about, 3%, or I think that came from a movie, or that we use 10% of our brain or something like that. Is it possible, if we use 10% of our brain, could that be equivalent to this left hemisphere, right hemisphere being separated, and to say that there's like 90% of things that are outside of our ability to perceive it? It's there. We just are blind to it the way that they're blind to the half of the face in this example. Is that possible? You know, I think about certain sound frequencies that are outside of our range. We evolved to hear within this frequency because that's the frequency that we needed in order to survive. We didn't need the other ones. The light is like that. We see some bands of light, others we don't. So could there be other things that are out there that they're there, but we just are blind to it? I don't know. It's a question, and this is, you know, I ask this question with a grain of salt and like very aware that this sounds like, yeah, I'm going right into the woo-woo magic stuff of this, but this is kind of what it's suggesting. So shouldn't we at least be a little more open to the possibility of it? And I don't even know how you would test for something like this, but it's fascinating.
Each neuron has a voltage, which can change when ions flow in or out of the cell. Once a neuron's voltage has reached a certain level, it will fire an electrical signal to other cells, which will repeat the process. When many neurons fire at the same time, we can measure these changes in the form of a wave. Brainwaves underpin almost everything going on in our minds, including memory, attention, and even intelligence. As they oscillate at different frequencies, they get classified in bands such as alpha, theta, and gamma. Each are associated with different tasks. Brainwaves allow brain cells to tune into the frequency corresponding to their particular task while ignoring irrelevant signals, similar to how a radio homes in on different waves to pick up radio stations. The transfer of information between neurons becomes optimal when their activity is synchronized. This is the same reason why we experience cognitive dissonance. The frustration caused by simultaneously holding two contradictory ideas. Will is merely the drive to reduce dissonance between each of our active neural circuits. Evolution can be seen as the same process where nature tries to adapt or resonate with its environment. By doing so, it evolved to a point where it became self-aware and began to ponder its own existence. When a person faces the paradox of wanting purpose while thinking that human existence is meaningless, cognitive dissonance occurs. Throughout history, this has led many to reach for spiritual and religious guidance, challenging science as it failed to give answers to existential questions, such as why or what am I? The left cerebral hemisphere is largely responsible for creating a coherent belief system in order to maintain a sense of continuity towards our lives. New experiences get folded into the pre-existing belief system. When they don't fit, they are simply denied.
Why? Why does this happen? Why is it that when our beliefs are challenged by something that doesn't fit our worldview, that we reject it? Why did the brain evolve to do that? What is the advantage to survival that would cause the brain to evolve to do that? I think the answer to that question is really beautifully explained by Harari in Sapiens and expanded on in Homo Deus, that there is an advantage to belonging to a group. And having an intersubjective belief system binds you together to this group and allows you to cooperate because you're operating under, you know, similar rules that are intersubjective rules and reinforced by a belief system. And in that cooperation, you have safety. So that's why we evolved this way. And maybe this is a scientific explanation as to what's going on when people are feeling the spirit. That, you know, what is the spirit? The brain is like rewarding your body for doing something that is benefiting it towards survival, right? You're doing something good. The brain's going to reward you for it. What are you doing? You're reinforcing your belief that binds you together as a group, that increases your chances for survival because now you can cooperate because you've been validated, and that validation triggers those chemicals and you feel good. And it doesn't matter if the belief is true or not. It matters if it's working to bring you together as a group. And I think that's where so many of us who have untangled ourselves from the truth claims of the Mormon Church fall short, because we're looking at, oh, the Tower of Babel couldn't have possibly happened. Noah's Ark couldn't have possibly happened. So many things. The list goes on and on. Tapirs in the Book of Mormon, Curalomes, everything. It's not true. Okay. Fine. But there's an evolutionary advantage for the people who are believing that in a group, and they're going to keep feeling the spirit. They're going to keep being rewarded by their body for doing this. Maybe. But it seems like there's something that's going on. There's some kind of a shift, and I don't know when it started. But what's happening now is that people are becoming more isolated in rejecting beliefs. Like there's a part of our very nature that evolved to be part of a community and to feel whole and to feel safe that we're losing, that we've lost. And this is biologically explained here by the way that the brain operates. I don't know, I think there's a lot more to say about this. It's really interesting and disturbing at the same time.
Counterbalancing this is the right cerebral hemisphere, which has the opposite tendency. Whereas the left hemisphere tries to preserve the model, the right hemisphere is constantly challenging the status quo. When the discrepant anomalies become too large, the right hemisphere forces a revision in our worldview. However, when our beliefs are too strong, the right hemisphere may not succeed in overriding our denial. This can create a profound confusion when mirroring others. When the neural connections that physically define our belief system are not strongly developed or active, then our consciousness, the unity of all the separate active circuits at that moment, may consist mainly of activity related to our mirror neurons. Just as when we experience hunger, our consciousness consists mostly of other neural interactions for consuming food. This is not the result of some core self giving commands to different cerebral areas. All the different parts of the brain become active and inactive and interact without a core. Just as the pixels on a screen can express themselves as a recognizable image when in unity, the convergence of neural interaction expresses itself as consciousness. At every moment, we are in fact a different image, a different entity when mirroring, when hungry, when watching this video. Every second, we become different persons as we go through different states.
Now, I may be getting this wrong, so I might have to have Michael come back on and talk about this at some point. But one of the things that he was telling me was how the different functions of the brain, the different systems that communicate together to have different functionality in the brain, it's the synergy of all of those acting at once that creates the whole person. Like the image that I think about is Voltron. If you remember that cartoon where the little robots come together and become one big robot, it's all those little pixels coming together and forming the letter that they talked about here. It's all of the different processes in the brain together that form one whole thing. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that if these things are true, then they would have been manifested in human nature going back in history. And so we might be able to see that other thinkers have observed these things. And in fact, one of the things that Michael gets really excited about is that Aristotle had some theories of the soul and what the soul is that Michael's now seeing in the fMRI imaging as he's looking at the different processes in the networks of the brain. That, I didn't know really about Aristotle. I had to have Michael explain it to me, but Aristotle was responding to Plato. And Plato was what we would think of as a dualist, that would say there's a spirit, there's a soul that is separate from our body, and what we really are is the spirit. That's what we actually are, this spirit. And Aristotle, there's more to it than that. But and Aristotle said, well, I'm kind of with you, but I don't think that it's this dualistic thing, that it's separate from our body. And so Aristotle's taking more of a materialist approach to it, and saying that if there is this soul, it's made up of a combination of things like appetitive drives, the appetite that we have, our sensations, our sensory systems, our intellect, our imaginative faculties, all of those things when they're operating at once and when they're all operating healthily, that's when you have a whole person, and that's your soul. That's your spirit. It's not something that's separate or outside. It's something that comes from you. And what Michael's saying is, I think that Aristotle got it right. And what we're able to see now is that those are the functions of the brain. Those are these different things that are coming together in one and creating a whole. So when Michael's talking about the spiritual brain, that's what the spirit is. It's that whole sense of self that I think the video is talking about here. And I found that very interesting as well. And why do I find it interesting? Because what it suggests is if you've got an intellectual faculty and an imaginative faculty, and you need all of them operating at their optimal health in order to have a really healthy soul, what you're talking about is to have the most fulfilling experience in life that you can possibly have. And so the imaginative faculty is where you experience the religion, that awe that comes from being a part of something that's bigger than you are. And that's what I think that I have rejected in leaving ex-Mormonism, because that was so painful. That part was so important to me, but also so painful. And I had all those emotions attached to the memories. Now I feel like I'm able to untangle those, and I want to fill that imaginative side again. I think I've got the intellect down pretty good. That's all right. I can still improve on that too. But trying to get that holistic experience. So we're talking about whether it's literal or a metaphor or whatever it is, I can understand it that way. That's why I think it's fascinating. And helpful to make me more happy. I want to be more happy. Don't you?
When we use our mirror neurons to look at ourselves, we may construct the idea of identity, But if we do this with our scientific understandings, we see something completely different. The neural synergies that produce our oscillating consciousness go far beyond our own neurons. We are equally the result of cerebral hemispheres interacting electrochemically, as we are of the senses connecting our neurons to other neurons in our environment. Nothing is external.
Oh my god, this was another one of those just like mind-blowing aha moments. So they spent all this time talking about the neural networks inside of your head connecting the right hemisphere to the left hemisphere and the functions and synergies and the different wavelengths and all this thing that's happening inside your head. It's saying, but your brain's not just responding to what's going on inside your head. And your mirror neurons, they're responding to things that are happening outside of your head. And, you know, go back to what I said earlier about me touching you right now. This is happening outside of your head. And what they're gonna go on to suggest, and again, we're getting to like the magic woo-woo thing, that the distinction between internal and external is an illusion. Where we really are all connected by our mirror neurons. If that's true, well, that has major implications, and especially if a religious goal is to create a Zion of one heart and one mind, and if you say we actually already are kind of one heart and one mind in the ways that we connect with each other through our mirror neurons, but we're not operating at our optimal levels. So like if Michael's talking about a world soul as a metaphor, that there's areas that we need to improve to have that holistic experience, because the world's kind of sick right now. We're all separate. We think we're separate, but we're impacting each other and we're driving each other. I don't know. I gotta be careful here. but it's wow.
Nothing is external. This is not a hypothetical philosophy. It is the basic property of mirror neurons, which allow us to understand ourselves through others. Seeing this neural activity as your own, while excluding the environment, would be a misconception. Our superorganismal features are also reflected in evolution, where our survival as primates relied on our collective abilities. Over time, the neocortical regions evolved to permit the modulation of primitive instincts and the overriding of hedonistic impulses for the benefit of the group. Our selfish genes have come to promote reciprocal social behaviors in superorganismal structures, effectively discarding the notion of survival of the fittest. The brain's neural activity resonates most coherently when there is no dissonance between these advanced new cerebral regions and the older, more primitive ones. What we traditionally call selfish tendencies is only a narrow interpretation of what self-serving behavior entails, wherein human characteristics are perceived through the flawed paradigm of identity, instead of through a scientific view on what we are. A momentary expression of an ever-changing unity with no center. The psychological consequences of this as an objective belief system allow self-awareness without attachment to the imagined self, causing dramatic increases in mental clarity, social conscience, self-regulation, and what's often described as being in the moment. The common cultural belief has mostly been that we need a narrative, a diachronic view on our life, to establish moral values. But with our current understandings of the empathic and social nature of the brain, we now know that a purely scientific view, with no attachment to our identity or story, yields a far more accurate, meaningful, and ethical paradigm than our anecdotal values. This is logical, since our traditional tendency to define ourselves as imaginary individualistic constants neurally wires and designs the brain towards dysfunctional cognitive processes, such as compulsive labeling and the psychological need to impose expectations. Practical labeling underpins all forms of interactions in our daily lives, but by psychologically labeling the self as internal and the environment as external, we constrain our own neurochemical processes and experience a diluted disconnection. Growth and its evolutionary side effects, such as happiness and fulfillment, are stimulated when we are not being labeled in our interactions. We may have many different views and disagree with one another in practical terms, but interactions that nevertheless accept us for who we are without judgment are neuropsychological catalysts that wire the human brain to acknowledge others and accept rationally verified belief systems without dissonance. Stimulating this type of neural activity and interaction alleviates the need for distraction or entertainment and creates cycles of constructive behavior in our environment. Sociologists have established that phenomena such as obesity and smoking, emotions and ideas spread and ripple through society in much the same way that electric signals of neurons are transferred when their activity is synchronized. We are a global network of neurochemical reactions, and the self-amplifying cycle of acceptance and acknowledgement, sustained by the daily choices in our interactions, is the chain reaction that will ultimately define our collective ability to overcome imagined differences and look at life in the grand scheme of things.
Or maybe the way we used to say it, the eternal perspective. So, look, I don't know how you're responding to this. I know how I'm responding to this. This is the kind of stuff that I want to explore. Like, I want to take, there's so many ideas in here that I want to like do a Bob double click on and do episodes that just focused on a couple of these ideas and from different perspectives and things like this. So this is what I want the future of Infants on Thrones to be, at least for the content that I generate for it. And if this is something that you're interested in coming on this journey, Patreon plug, sure, please. Support us on Patreon. If this is something that you're interested in, that's not why I'm doing this right here. I'm not doing this to try and get you to do Patreon, but it would help. That's kind of my job now. So for me to be involved and keep doing this, it helps to have that support. Anyway, there's other ways to support too. I want to do some listener essay contest starting in 2018, where we'll have some topics and we can have listeners submit their essays, and then you guys can vote on the ones that you like the best, and the winner will get a cash prize, kind of like we've been doing the reverse tithing for the patron or the patron of the month. Also, don't forget that there's a survey waiting for you to fill out on the website, infantsonthrones.com, just because I want to hear what you thought about this. I want to know. So go to the website and fill out the survey, please. Thank you. So cool things going forward. It's not the end of Infants on Thrones. It's not the end of Infants on Thrones ripping on Mormonism either. You know, that's going to keep happening. But like going in this direction, that's what I'm interested in doing. And I hope that you're interested in it too. If not,
remarkable. Say remarkable.
I don't know. I'm going to say something kind of... I don't know. So thank you once again for listening to Infants on Thrones.
Hi, this is Jessica from Wardle, Salt Lake City. Sorry. I used to take care of the general authorities and the prophet's wife in home care as a nurse. which may or may not have contributed to my shelf breaking. Anyway, that's another story. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com, and if you really like what you hear, give the quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones. Infants on Thrones.